This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. So where's the bus? That's the top complaint of public transit users in Miami-Dade County. Two out of every three rides on the county's public transit system are bus rides. 224,000 rides on a bus in Miami-Dade on the average day. In the first half of this year, people took 38 million trips on a bus in Miami-Dade County. And over the past year and a half, 27,000 complaints about those rides or drivers or fellow riders have been filed. Almost half of those gripes have to do with the bus schedule. Where's the bus? The Miami Herald crunched the data and put together a map that shows which bus lines are the worst in the county. Now, at a time when this community is having a serious debate over addressing its transportation needs now and figuring out how to build for tomorrow's demands of getting around town, how does bad bus service today impact how we use public transportation if we use it at all? And how about paying for it? The bus is how most transit users get around, so where are buses in the debate over mobility? Are county taxpayers getting what they pay for? Are riders? Do you ride a bus in Miami, Broward, Palm Beach, or the Keys? What's your experience been? Join the Florida Roundup here as we begin with mass transit. 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. You can send us a tweet at WLRN and on Facebook, facebook.com/group/TheFloridaRoundup. Doug Hanks covers Miami-Dade County for the Miami Herald and put together the look at the filthy buses in the county. Doug, what were the biggest complaints that you found?
Number one complaint is late bus, and I think number two was no-show. And the cause of the late bus, the missing bus, the bus that's so full it passes by, when you talk to transit people, is mechanical breakdown. Miami-Dade County is one of the least reliable bus fleets in the country of the major systems because it's got one of the oldest fleets, and it just breaks down all the time.
Were there specific routes that had concentrated problems, or was this mostly spread across the system?
No, there were definitely specific routes where you saw more complaints, and we try to be a little careful about suggesting that just because there's more complaints, that means, in fact, there are more late buses, because other factors could be at work. But we featured a guy in the story who was waiting for the number 27 on 27th Avenue trying to get to the Coconut Grove Metro Rail Station, and he said, the bus missed its first stop, its second stop, its third stop, its fourth stop. Wait, it's supposed to take a 10-minute trip. He waited an hour for the bus. It's like on Thursday morning, guys trying to get to work.
Sure, yeah, morning drive.
And we asked transit, what happened here? And they said, well, the first bus had a breakdown. The second bus had some sort of malfunction. And we usually have two spare buses, but they were elsewhere. So this is a system under strain because of a lack of money.
Miami-Dade County Commissioner Esteban Bovo Jr. is with us. He represents the 13th District, but for this discussion, he's the chair of the Commission's Transit and Mobility Committee. Commissioner Bovo, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Nice to hear from you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Hello, Doug.
Hi there.
So, Commissioner, as you read through the Herald's report, you look at the map, you hear the complaints, not only within Doug's reporting, but elsewhere on the dirty buses and the late buses. Commissioner, what's your response?
Well, it's clear that the system that we've created, along with the way we've developed our communities and linked them through roads, has created what I call a perfect storm and ripe for us to start exploring alternatives to just the basic bus system that has to go across town. And I wasn't surprised by the report, quite honestly. As I was reading through it, it reminded me of a time that my staff and I picked up a bus off of 107th Avenue near International Mall with the ideas of going into Kendall, and a trek that would normally take you about maybe 15 to 20 minutes in your car turned into a 2.5-hour ordeal. And a lot of the same things, you know, we were at a bus stop, no shelter, buses going by us that were not our route or were out of service. And I could only imagine the person that's out there dressed in a suit, perhaps going to a job interview, and having to, you know, be out in the elements waiting for a bus. Once they get on that bus and get to that job interview, you know, they might get kicked out of the interview process for a lot of reasons. And to me, it becomes very taxing on the individuals that rely on our system to literally go to a job interview, get to work, It's not fair to them.
What Doug, I think, uncovered here, Commissioner, is the reliability factor, and that's what you talk about. Not only the reliability in terms of the believability of the bus schedules, but the reliability of the timing once you get on a bus, and the reliability of the cleanliness of that bus and the service of that bus. The county budget this year is going to buy 43 new accordion buses. You guys are working through plans with the commission to buy 300 additional regular size buses. Is this going to address and alleviate some of the reliability issues, Commissioner?
Well, unfortunately, because our system right now relies so much heavily on buses, we have to make the investment into improving our bus fleet. But I will be honest with you, and quite frankly, I do not envision the crosstown bus as being a mode of transportation in the future. What I'd like to see, and what I'd like to see, you know, over the next 5, 10, 15 years is a commitment from the department and future elected officials to create a system that allows for more local systems that are basically moved within a community, and perhaps these systems all link to what would be main corridors. And I've talked extensively about east-west corridor, mm-hmm. but you could really attribute it to a lot of different corridors where a system that, let's say, for example, argument's sake, feeds the Doral area and allows that to pick up folks and bring them to a main line. And that main line could be either light rail or metro rail that then spans out through our county. And I think we need to start looking at what did the people want when they supported the halfpenny and the people's transportation plan? What have we done up to this point, which the answer is obvious, not enough. And then finally, how do we now start fulfilling the promise that was made to the voters and that the voters bought into it? And while Metro Rail, I think, is prohibitive, and I don't think we're going to see any more investment of $100+ million per mile on Metro Rail, but I do think there are some very affordable opportunities for us to take advantage of some existing rail lines that we have now, and then perhaps along with the transit department, kind of reinvent the way we move folks.
One of those reinventions.
It doesn't have to be the cross-county anymore.
Sure. You have focused some of your efforts, Commissioner Bovo, on the discussion regarding rail and using existing rail that's in place now for perhaps some kind of commuter passenger service in the east-west corridor. Back in September here on WLRN, we spoke with Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez about other options on that east-west mm-hmm. corridor, including BRT, Bus Rapid Transit, that he identified as an option for congestion, specifically on the Dolphin Expressway.
The 836, we can use a BRT,
bus rapid transit,
and that can be put in, you know, rather quickly. But we have
a lot faster than a train.
A lot faster than a train, and a lot cheaper than a train too. And you start out with that, and then you expand it.
Commissioner Bovo, would you support that kind of effort on BRT, bus rapid transit, on these major expressway corridors as an initial spot for faster kind of a main corridor commuting?
Look, I think that as a startup service, as a way of showing the community of a commitment to address these areas, particularly now talking about east-west, look, I have no apprehension to that. As long as we keep focused on an alternative that is longer in term. And I believe that allowing us to be able to have a discussion with CSX, have the state as a participant in this, and securing perhaps these corridors, which is about 36 miles of corridor, one going east-west, another one heading southwest all the way down to Florida City, I believe that given a choice between a bus and the reliability of a light rail system, I think many folks are going to start moving toward the concept of a light rail.
Certainly that would be the case if they've read Doug Hanks's pieces in the Miami Herald and don't want to put up with the cockroaches and some of the other issues that you've identified in your complaint piece, Doug.
Yeah, well, we didn't do the Metro Rail complaints, but for sure bus gets a lot more complaints. And that is one of the problems for buses. It has a stigma of it being largely for poor people being the bottom tier of the rung. And it certainly doesn't get as much political attention as rails do. But one thing that's interesting.
But the ridership for the buses is there. Two out
massive.
Of every.
It's the most popular transit
over,
mode in
almost
the county.
Almost a quarter of a million average weekday rides. Two out of every three riders that ride a Miami-Dade public transit offer are going to get on a bus.
Yeah, absolutely. More people are on buses in Miami-Dade County than jets in Miami International Airport.
Well, but, and let's be honest, because the way we built our metro station, going north and south with very limited service, you have completely blocked out the entire western end of the county. You've blocked out, for the most part, a lot of the northern end of the county, southwest end of the county. A lot of the residents in our community that would rely on buses or may even consider an alternative mode of transportation, not other than a bus, that has not been given to them. And I think the mission has to be, can we give them an alternative? I think there's going to be a generation. I've said this many, many times. There's going to be a generation that's going to judge us on what did we do in our time here in power and in the decision-making abilities. And I believe these alternatives are something that we need to give folks.
But let me ask you a question. I mean, there's people that rely on the bus. You really got this from the complaints. That these are people who rely on the bus to get them from their home to their work. And if they're 5 minutes late, it's a problem. Do you feel like Miami-Dade County is spending enough on its bus system today?
Doug, we've been forced to expend the money we've expended on the system today because it's all we have at this point. And I think perhaps we haven't expended enough money, which speaks to a lot of the condition of many of the buses, and then we have to go into these massive expenditures, to buy articulated buses and whatnot. I think for a long time, the transit department, to their defense, has been playing catch up all the time. They have not really been, in my opinion, aggressive enough to be to be looking at the potential of the long term in the future. I think one of the things that's happened now, because of the MDX component in it, because of the frustration that a lot of people have with the current system, it allowed us now to maybe open up more and more of this conversation. I'll tell you, Doug, I'm sure you found this. This is the first time I've seen elected officials countywide at all different levels of government, House, local level, commission, whatnot. All of us are talking about the same thing now.
Yeah,
and all of us are trying to get to a solution.
It spreads, but talking about rail, I would say.
And it spreads certainly over county lines. We're hearing, obviously, the similar discussions in regards to Broward County bus transit, Palm Beach County bus transit. But talking about public transit overall and paying for it. In 2014, for every dollar of operating expenses in public transit in the United States, 37 cents came from passenger fares. So that means two-thirds of operating expenses of public transportation, that includes rail, it includes light rail, it includes buses, it includes automated facilities like the Metro Mover here, two-thirds of it is coming from tax-supported subsidies. Back in September, again, when we spoke with the Miami-Dade County Mayor, Carlos Jimenez, about transportation, we asked him how much passengers actually pay for transportation.
Our fare box recovery is 30%. That means 70% of the system is actually subsidized either by the state, federal, or you and me, when we pay our property taxes, mm-hmm. we're actually subsidizing the transit system of Miami-Dade County, too.
Now, Commissioner Bovo, I know the commission has talked about, through the mayor, has talked about raising fares over the course of the past several years. That really hasn't gotten any traction here as the broader economy has gotten better. The county hasn't necessarily had to do it for the general fund, but should fares rise?
Well, I think the potential is if you start raising the fares, you're going to start impacting directly the folks that most need or most depend on the transit system. Look, I think, and here's where, my philosophy kind of comes crashing here, okay? I believe that there are certain services that government provides that are services that should not be measured in the same vein as, let's say, private businesses are to be measured. And I think, this is a service that we provide. And there are some on the commission that have even talked about fare-free services where we can subsidize all of the service. And that might open the door, for public-private partnerships in the future. But I'm not convinced that raising the fares is going to improve the service, so to speak. And I'm not sure if I'm going to be penalizing really the folks that need it the most, the ones at the lower rung, economic rung of our community.
Let me make one point on that as well. When you ride a road, a county road, 100% of that is subsidized by taxes. And the few exceptions where the motorists do actually pay for it are the MDX highways, mm-hmm. and everyone throws a fit mm-hmm. when they raise the tolls. And yet you see massive infrastructure projects up and down the 836
sure.
at a time when really there's a national lecture about not spending enough on infrastructure. So it's a different way to look at government dollars.
One thing, and I'm glad you mentioned that, Doug, because you know the other thing is we have this conversation. We've done a lot of work over the years to make it convenient for the car, and perhaps we should be looking this at a different lens and make it inconvenient for the car. You know, make it friendlier for people to be able to use a system. You know, we go to places like Washington, New York, and Chicago, and for all of a sudden, we become experts at their transit system because we use their subways and whatnot. And when we come back home, we're like, you know, we're paralyzed. Now, I know the dynamic's different. You're there on vacation and whatnot. But I could tell you from a person that goes to D.C. on a regular basis, I'm very comfortable taking the train from the airport to the hotel, never using, never renting a car or what have you, Ubering where I need to Uber. And I would tell you that that's maybe we should start looking in that dynamic, because I think in the long run it's going to cost us productivity wise, and it's going to cost us as far as companies looking to us as investment opportunities.
Well, sitting in traffic in terms of time and money costs the average South Floridian over $1,000 a year in lost productivity. We're talking about mass transit, public transit in Miami-Dade County and throughout South Florida. Doug Hanks covers Miami-Dade County government for our partner, the Miami Herald, and County Commissioner Esteban Bovo Jr. is the District 13 representative and heads up the commission's transportation committee. Commissioner Bovo, you've talked about really kind of focused on moving away from the car culture that's been created and the car culture mindset that perhaps has directed public transit dollars and public transit planning over the course of the better part of a couple of generations. In March, you appeared on WPBT's At Issue program with Helen Ferre and told her this.
Everything that we've talked about up to this point in our transit has all been bus driven. And Helen, I don't know a lot of people that ride buses. I don't know a lot of people that are interested in riding buses. The bus culture, I don't think, is a solution.
So in your estimation, Commissioner Bovo, should buses not be part of the evolution of mass transit in Miami-Dade County?
Well, but buses will forever be part of the evolution in the conversation, because we're not going to build light rail or train lines to every part of our community. But I think the way we think about buses could be an asset. For example, I've talked about what they've doing in different areas with trolleys, interlocal type systems that just feed a general area and take you to a main line. What I think is, in my opinion, is really a lost leader is this cross-county bus, where you need to literally get on a bus and then, you know, you're in traffic. Then you may do an exchange to get on another bus that gets into traffic. And that commute, similar to my commute that I mentioned earlier from International Mall to Kendall, becomes a two and a half hour commute. Folks,
what about replacing those?
Where everything's instant.
Yeah, sure. What about replacing those with bus rapid transit with fewer stops, or even on the surface streets, the local routes having fewer stops on there, and trying to run express buses and optimizing the traffic signals?
And that's a good point, because the mayor did bring or tried to bring a plan last year of trying to streamline the bus system, and it never went anywhere on the commission. I was going to be supportive of it, because what we've done with a lot of our bus systems and our routes is that we've become and we've made them social service programs. So we go into neighborhoods that, quite honestly, somebody may be able to walk two blocks to get to a main line. Because that example I was giving you earlier, mm-hmm. we were gyrating through neighborhoods to get to Kendall, which all it did was add to the distance and the time of the travel. So if we could, and I think the mayor and I are like-minded on this, if we could kind of like streamline the current system, make it straight, I think it ends up saving us money in the long run, perhaps makes it more efficient, and then accomplishes the goal that I'd like to see, where these lines are taking you to corridors. And I would hope in the future in Miami-Dade County, when you get to a corridor, like in Chicago, you're going to get on a train that's going to take you either to a main area like the MIC or downtown and give you options. Now, what I'm saying is a different mindset than whatever we've had in Dade County. I grew up in Dade County. I need my car. I'm plugged into the car culture. But I have a five-year-old that I'm hoping will have alternatives to that car culture, yeah, which today they don't have.
We have seen some municipalities within Dade County respond perhaps to this idea of trying to put disincentives in front of drivers. I'm thinking specifically in part of Miami Beach, raising parking meter fares as a way to not only generate dollars for a trolley system that the mayor in Miami Beach wants to build, but perhaps to act as an economic disincentive for folks to drive. Commissioner, in Miami-Dade, in the places that you could, I suppose, control parking fares, would you recommend increasing those as a deterrent?
Well, that could be part of the remedy to get people to consider leaving their cars and maybe using alternatives. I'll tell you, though, raising the fare and not giving folks alternatives, that could come into that could be a political nightmare. An area that we should be looking at, and I would hope that the county commission start addressing this sooner than later, is this issue of Uber and Lyft. You know, we've talked a lot about our bus system and transit systems. You know, in many communities now, there are that last mile that always becomes an argument against our system, because in D.C. or New York, you may take a subway and then you're going to walk a couple of blocks underground before you get out of the system. Here, when you get off, you're off. And we have a question of how do you bridge that last mile to make it easier on folks?
Yeah, but Doug Hanks, I mean, is Uber or these other transportation networking companies a real solution to that, especially concerning the almost 250,000 average daily trips of the folks that are taking those bus trips? Is Uber maybe cheaper than a cab, but is it the value of time saved, is it still going to be enough to pay the $5 or the $10, whatever that last mile may cost, as opposed to staying on the bus for an extra 20 minutes or a half an hour?
We hear about these efforts around the country. It's called the Uber Bus, where there is, I think, really is ride sharing, which is sort of their brand, where you say, hey, I want to get picked up, and there's someone else who's going to get picked up, and it's a little bit more of a route. So I think that that is a real possibility. My question would be, as you get rid of stops and then say Uber can sort of take over, what does that do for the lowest income people? Now, maybe they're already taken care of, as the commissioner said, through a social services, subsidy fare, et cetera. But I think that's going to be the challenge, is as you shrink the bus reach, what happens to the people who really depend on it?
Commissioner Bovo, we've referred to kind of the promise of public transportation to Miami-Dade residents. This goes back more than a decade to the 0.5% sales tax in 2002. As you move forward, is that 0.5% sales tax enough?
Well, if we're going to trust our good people at the county who have crunched the numbers and they tell us that we're going to have a spending capacity over the next 25 years of anywhere between $2 to $3 billion, I would say yes. I think we have adequate money if we are judicious the way we spend it. What we can't do, and what I'm very fearful of, is some conversations of having a shotgun approach and trying to address all the corridors at once. I think what we should do, and I've advocated about East-West, but I'm open to other corridors going first. To me, that's more of a political argument. But we need to get one of them done. We need to get one done, because at this point, the one constant is this. Our residents have lost total faith in government's ability to handle this situation. And since I became the chair of transportation, which is a good thing, but I'm not sure if it is a good thing, I get all the complaints about it, and people are asking us, you know, fix it. Don't ask me for any more money, because we already gave you enough money. You haven't done anything with it. So I think this is where now we really need to put up or shut up. There is no more, as far as I'm concerned, no more analyzing, no more studies to be done. Let's look at a corridor. Let's get it done. You know, we believe the money is there, not only just to be able to purchase the corridor. We believe that the money will be there to be able to do the startup service and trying to be creative with a lot of the things that we're looking at, like TIFs and TODs and other ways of creating revenue around the stations and around the corridor.
Commissioner Bovo, let me ask you in our final moments here, in your estimation, it's time for action. In 1 year's time, Halloween of next year, of 2016, right before Election Day, what's going to be different in Miami-Dade County Transit?
I will hope that by that time, the Miami-Dade County has ownership of the CSX corridors, and we've done a ceremonial event that will start up service at the beginning of, what was the date you said, next year, right? January by 17.
January by 17. All right, we'll give you an extra 6 weeks there. Miami-Dade Commissioner Esteban Bovo Jr., thank you, Commissioner. We appreciate your time. Doug Hanks, covering county government for us here, and our partner at the Miami Herald. Great stuff, Doug. Great. Thanks for sharing it with us. Still to come on our program, another special session on redistricting ends in Tallahassee. Still no agreement. And we'll talk about the rebranding of Jeb Bush. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Florida lawmakers have left Tallahassee without drawing a new political map again, and former Governor Jeb Bush is trying to fix it. It's all about politics here on the Florida Roundup in the state of Florida. So let's begin with the former governor. Bush's new presidential campaign slogan, Jeb can fix it, and he means his own White House effort.
The law is clear that you are not tasked with achieving the best.
After 7 years of incompetence, corruption, and gridlock in Washington, we need a president who can fix it. I can fix it. I know I can fix it because I've done it.
Bush's performance in the most recent GOP debate has stepped up pressure on the candidate. And then, of course, a series of disappointing poll results came out this week, including getting only 7% support among Florida Republicans. That was in a Bay News 9 Tampa poll. That's also where he kicked off his fix-it effort this week, acknowledging he's been getting plenty of advice on how to do it.
Some is stylistic. Take off the suit coat. Ditch the glasses. Get rid of the purple striped tie. Some advice is more strategic. Nail that zinger. Be angrier. Hide your inner wonk.
So is it the fact that the candidate is too wonky, or is it the policies that he is espousing? Talking about the rebranding of Jeb Bush on the presidential campaign trail here, John O'Connor watches education and politics for us here at WLRN. S.V. Dante is White House correspondent for National Journal, author of Jeb, America's Next Bush. He covered Governor Bush in Tallahassee as the bureau chief for the Palm Beach Post. S.V. Dante joining us from Washington, D.C. Sharish, tell us, why has Bush been unable to translate the millions, dozens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, really, of campaign donations into early voter support?
Well, I think so far the campaign's really about who gets insulted by Donald Trump and how they deal with it and whether that's funny or not. And Jeb has a problem with that. Governor Bush is a serious guy, and I think a campaign that's centered around a TV reality show personality is kind of I don't think that's what he signed up for when he got into this race.
Well, John O'Connor, the biggest insult, I suppose, that candidate Trump gave to Governor Bush was calling him low energy in one of the first GOP debates.
Right. And you've kind of heard him snidely refer to that a couple of times since. I mean, I think what Sharish was talking about is there's kind of a fundamental mismatch between the type of candidacy Jeb wants to run here versus the type of candidacy that it seems like Republican voters want. The whole adult in the room approach that Jeb is taking doesn't seem to match up, because it seems very much like Republican voters want an outsider. They want somebody who's going to go to Washington and just kind of burn everything down and start over again.
So is it the man? Is it the message? Is it the process of this campaign? Is it the policies it's espousing?
All of the above. I mean, they all contribute. I think if you talk to political analysts, political scientists, and folks like that, they'll tell you the fundamentals are the fundamentals. And in this case, the fundamentals of the Republican primary voters right now seem to be they want somebody from the outside. They want somebody who doesn't have D.C. experience, who is not going to, bring any of the current mindset to the job.
Sharish, how about it? The man, the message, the process, the politics.
Right. Well, what I did for this was I went out and reached out to President Herman Cain to see what he thought about how these things. Right. That's a big deal to remember, is we are in November and things change, and they change quite a lot. I mean, when I was out in Iowa recently and talked to people about what they knew about the presidential race, it struck me how little they actually knew and how much official D.C. and the political press are obsessed with this, when actual people who will actually show up on February 1st that night haven't really paid that much attention yet. So I don't know what these polls mean right now, but I do think that basing our opinions on who's winning, who's not, I don't know. I mean, again, look back to the previous cycles.
I mean, Bush has raised more than $100 million. He's got a great infrastructure. He's got very smart people working for him. And as Sheree said, it's early. There's time to turn this around.
There is time, but that, obviously that's been no guarantee thus far in the campaign. And you're right. I mean, the polls are the easy part of the process for the media to report on. It's much more difficult to get into the meat of the policies. But the polls also drive that conversation to some degree that the candidate is having or wants to have with his or her potential supporters. Mary Ellen Kloss covers Tallahassee for our partner, the Miami Herald, joins us from WFSU right now. You see these Florida polls, for instance, where presumably it would be a neck-and-neck race with Bush and Senator Rubio, but Bush is in the single digits in his adopted home state, Mary Ellen. What does that lack of support mean for the campaign and whether or not it can fix it on a national scale?
Well, I think it's very telling, and I think it's huge. I think, you know, it'll be 14 years since Jeb Bush was on the ballot in Florida, and that's pretty close to a generation. There's a lot of people who just don't, what they know of Jeb is what they know of his brother and his legacy, and I think they see him as a bit of a dynasty character. But I also think there is, when it comes to the Republican voters in Florida, the fact is that they know who Jeb Bush is. The primary voters, those that will show up in the presidential primary in Florida. And I think so that's the disconnect. I think what we have is the general public and the general interest polls show that he's down. I think people are looking at Marco Rubio as kind of the rising star in the party. But when you look at the establishment folks, the people that are that run the political operation and the political organization, and even the people that served with Marco Rubio in the Florida legislature, they're all Jeb people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a clash between, I think, you know, where is the populist image and where's the organization and the traditional Republican institution.
Sheree Dante Abid, how about that? What is this, a failure of the traditional Republican infrastructure? When we look at what Governor Bush is doing or failing to be able to strike a chord with Republican voters?
Well, again, I think we go back to Republican voters where the number one indicator of how Florida Republicans are going to vote, I think, is going to be the winner of the South Carolina primary. I mean, look back in previous cycles. A person who does well there suddenly jumps up 10 or 15 points in the polls.
So, yeah, there's an Iowa bump. There's a New Hampshire bump. There's a Super Tuesday bump, no doubt about it.
Right. So I don't know how much effort they are putting into Florida right now. I don't know how much effort they should be putting into Florida right now. But his bigger problem, his way bigger problem, is New Hampshire and then South Carolina. And then, as you point out, those 10 or 11 Super Tuesday states on the first. How he does there is really going to affect how he does in Florida.
And he is putting the money to work, John O'Connor. I mean, he's buying several million dollars worth of television advertising in New Hampshire. Is it going to move the needle?
He's been spending in all three states, or early primary states, and I mean, so far we haven't seen a whole lot of evidence of it that it is moving the needle. He's in fifth in all, you know, in the summary of polls in all three of those states, and the trend has not been positive in recent weeks.
We've got another Republican debate coming up. This latest rebranding effort came out of the most previous debate, and certainly all the knock-on criticism of the process of the debate itself, in my estimation, well-deserved. But we have another Republican debate on the eve. Does it do Governor Bush well and his campaign to participate, or John O'Connor, should he potentially opt out?
I don't think opting out's a great idea, just because he's coming off such a poor performance that it just gives more fuel to the speculation from folks like us and from pundits that this is a campaign that's in trouble. I think the better choice is probably to participate and to do well.
I guess, SV, in order to control the message, you got to be in there during the making of the message.
Right. I it'd be nuts to drop out. I think that would be basically admitting I can't do this, I'm done, and everyone would then be, you know, writing about the, when's he going to quit? Is he going to quit before Thanksgiving? Or I mean, and really, the only people who are reading these stories right now are the donor class. So that's what he needs to worry about.
Which are important at this point, right?
Absolutely important.
I want to ask you about the legacy aspect here, because just within the past couple of days, a new biography on President George Herbert Walker Bush, Jeb Bush's father, excerpts were released, and having the former president criticizing advisors to his son, of course, Jeb's brother, while he was president. How does this reflect on Jeb's own presidential ambitions, do you think?
Well, I think the timing could not have been worse for Jeb, because Mary Ellen remembers this back in 1994, how irritated Jeb got when his brother got into the governor's race in Texas. He wanted this to be about him and Florida and nothing else. And for the last 20 years, it's about everything else other than those few things that Jeb wanted it to be about.
Mary Ellen, how about it? What about the Bush legacy through two presidencies and now maybe new shades of it here with this new biography?
I agree with Sharish. I think it was really shocking, practically, to understand that they allowed this to come out at the timing they did. I think it diverts the attention to some degree. It again forces both of his sons to be explaining, and what it also does is it really reinforces this idea that this is a long-serving dynasty, and I don't think that works well, that reminder.
Let's talk about state politics here, because it was just late Thursday that the Florida Senate rejected a redrawn map of its own political boundaries here in the Sunshine State, ends yet another special session here in 2015 on redistricting. An earlier session to redraw Florida's U.S. congressional districts also ended with no agreement in the State House. This week, senators criticized the constitutional amendment that's the heart of all this redistricting effort. Mary Ellen, now back up to a judge again. Third time is not the charm for the legislators to figure out a way to redraw political boundaries. What's the challenge here? What's the problem? Is the constitutional amendment itself at the heart of it?
Well, I think the constitutional amendment is a difficult It sets a series of guidelines that are very difficult for politicians to adhere to, and that is to not create maps that intentionally benefit themselves. And that goes to the heart of why this has been such a difficult struggle for them. They have to agree to basically allow people of their colleagues to be voted out of office. The reason this is the original map was rejected is it because it artificially protected so many Republicans in Congress and in the Senate. And the solution to that is to remove the protections. And they just couldn't figure out a way to do that and also pass a bill. So they ended both of these sessions without agreement. And, you know, if you look at the big picture, it's going to mean that whichever map comes through, even the last map that came out of the House that was ultimately they were unable to find the votes for in the Senate, would have given Democrats four additional seats. That made it about a 22-18 divide, with Republicans in command of two more seats than Democrats in the state Senate. The maps drawn by the challengers in this that are likely to be presented to the courts create a 20-20 parity in the Senate, mm-hmm. or give Democrats a 21-19 advantage. That's why this is so hard.
Yeah, big politics are at stake. You know, Sharish, when you look at your time spent in Tallahassee and what it is today, you've got the benefit of a little bit of time and space now. Has much changed?
I don't think a whole lot's changed, and admittedly, I've paid as little attention to what's happening in Tallahassee as possible. But I did think at the time when that passed that it was going to be near impossible for them to actually abide by the by the rules of what that constitutional amendment said.
And John O'Connor, we've heard that from the redistricting chair, the senator who chaired this group, saying that the law is tasks legislators not with achieving the best map, but with a constitutionally compliant map. Why are those two things mutually exclusive?
Well, because the people who want the constitutional amendment don't have to get elected. And as we keep pointing out here time and time again, that these decisions that they're being asked to make will cost colleagues their jobs, most likely.
And so are we asking, maybe we're asking the right question, but to the wrong people?
Possibly, yes.
John O'Connor covering some politics and education for us here at WLRN. Thanks, John. Always great to have you on. Esfidante with the National Journal with us from Washington. Sharish, nice to hear from you again. Thanks for joining us again. Mary Ellen,
pleasure.
Stick around. We got plenty more to come from Tallahassee and here in South Florida. For-profit college closes, thousands of students without classes, the owner faces charges, and lingering questions about political connections and for-profit schools in Florida. back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. It's been a week now since the sudden closing of the for-profit school Dayton Medical College, and the owner has been arrested. Students are still scrambling to find a new place to get their education. The college and its six campuses went out of business a week ago, plus two campuses of an affiliated school, the University of Southernmost Florida. Things then got worse for owner Ernesto Perez after the college closed. He was arrested this week for alleged campaign finance violations. His companies and contacts contributed more than $170,000 to state and federal political candidates. Mike Vasquez has been following the story and for-profit education in South Florida and throughout the state for our partner, the Miami Herald. And Mary Ellen Kloss heads up the Tallahassee Bureau for the Miami Herald with us from Tallahassee still. Mike, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Nice to hear from you.
Good to be here.
So what happened with Dade Medical College here?
Simply put, the bottom fell out. We've been writing about Dade Medical College for 2 years, almost exactly. And there's been a whole hornet's nest of issues surrounding the school for some time. And really, the only folks who probably weren't paying attention or didn't feel compelled to act were some of the elected officials up in Tallahassee. You had the U.S. Department of Education responding to our coverage by paying a surprise visit to the school back in September. And they stayed for almost the whole week looking over their finances. And pretty shortly after that, they placed the school on something of a probationary status that slows down the federal money that is any for-profit college's lifeblood.
Yeah.
And after that, they really couldn't sustain themselves without you, me, and the rest of the taxpayers.
That began essentially the clock ticking on its longevity here, because what, about 90% of the school's revenues come from taxpayers?
Exactly. Their audited financial statements, there's 1 year where they calculated that 89.97% or something like that of their revenues came from taxpayers, and the federal cap is 90%. And there is some scrutiny there in terms of whether or not those numbers are legitimate. But certainly, I mean, they live and breathe because of Uncle Sam and because of taxpayers. And really, there was a pattern there that persisted for quite some time, particularly with their physical therapy assistant program, of, you know, students complaining about deception and being sold a bill of goods, signed up for an unaccredited program where you pay $40,000 for essentially a degree that won't get you anywhere. It's a car with no engine.
Amanda Maria Q is a former student of Dade Medical College, joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Amanda, what were you studying at the college?
I was studying the RN program.
You wanted to be a registered nurse. How far along were you in your education?
I was right in the middle of clinicals, which is about my third month into the program.
So you woke up a week ago, Friday morning, expecting what? To go to class? To go to clinic?
Actually, we only run, our clinicals only run from Monday through Thursday, but because we had a final on the Monday coming up, they opened up the skills lab for us to practice. So I was there with a lot of the students just practicing.
You were at the skills lab preparing for a test the following Monday. What happened a week ago?
Well, we showed up. We were there all day long, and the teachers were helping us. The director was helping us make sure we were doing just fine. We went home about 3 o'clock, and I got a frantic phone call at 4 o'clock that we got an email about the school closure.
And what happened next?
I was in utter shock. I had actually thought that it may have been a mistake or a joke or anything. I went to the school, and there was teachers and staff and students all outside of the building, and the gates were bolted shut. People were crying, and I mean, I couldn't get any answers out of anybody because nobody knew what was going on.
Mike Vasquez with the Miami Herald. Are there answers forthcoming for students like Amanda?
It's tough. There's no real clean, easy solution here. And this is why it's so important to have oversight from both the state and federal government on the front end. I mean, basically, students can choose to have their loans forgiven, which means forfeiting the credits they've earned and starting from scratch at, let's say, Miami-Dade College. Or there are programs at the technical colleges that school districts have that also offer nursing, and those are pretty good programs as well. But it's hard for students who are already maybe a year or two invested to give up the credits they've earned. If they want to can keep those credits, they have to go to another for-profit college. And some of the operators out there that are soliciting, you know, trying to get to the students and saying, hey, come to us. Some of those for-profit operators that are going after students have checkered records of their own.
Mary Ellen Kloss, meantime, regulators are already in committee meetings in terms of state legislators for the 2016 legislative session. Where's this on their radar? Do we anticipate any action?
Well, you know, I think up until this time, it was a see no evil enterprise for Florida legislators. I mean, they not only kind of they open the doors for more for the kinds of excesses and the problems that they didn't try and put any barriers or hurdles up at all. And as Mike has really outlined and detailed in a lot of his reporting, they actually created loopholes and opened avenues for them to do things like open programs without the sufficient kinds of accreditation. And so they either, right now, the question is on them. What are they going to peel back in terms of closing some of these opportunities that they've created, and will they introduce any new oversight? Because at this point, it's an open question, and the irony is that there are quite a number of legislators who are personally benefiting from this industry.
In terms of actual jobs or just from contributions?
Having legal clients, mm-hmm. and Mike has also documented all of that.
Amanda, I'm curious.
And then taking political contributions.
Yeah, Amanda, what would you like lawmakers to know about your experience as they go into another law writing session that may or may not address some of the shortcomings that led to the situation you're in now, which is studying to be a registered nurse and your college goes out of business?
I feel that they should have to work faster to be able to guide us better. I mean, this whole entire thing, it happened so fast that I know a lot of people were kind of blown away by it all of a sudden, and so people weren't prepared for this, but I think they need to have plans already established. That way, when things like this do happen, that the ball can be moving a lot faster. Because, I mean, as of now, we're within a week of this happening, and people are still confused and lost and don't know what to do. People are still trying to protest down south. And me personally, it just doesn't seem like it's going to go anywhere with me but a waste of time. So I've had to make that decision to let go of my credits and try to find another place to basically start over. Because I am not going to put myself at risk to going to a for-profit school just in case this happens again.
Are you still determined to be a registered nurse, Amanda?
I am going to be determined to just have to be able to let some things go, move on, and start fresh again and hope that this doesn't happen again.
Amanda, good luck. Thanks for sharing your story with us. Amanda Maria Q, a now former student of the defunct Dade Medical College. She's a member of our Public Insight Network here at WLRN and the Miami Herald. Mike Vasquez, watching the for-profit college situation for our partner, the Miami Herald. Thanks for sharing the latest with us, Mike. Always appreciated.
You got it.
And Marilyn Kloss with us from Tallahassee, WFSU, where she heads up the Tallahassee Bureau of our partner, the Miami Herald. Marilyn, always nice to hear from you as well.
Thank you.
Finally, on the roundup this week, WLRN has partnered with the Miami Book Fair International. We want you to share a sticky story about South Florida. We're inviting our audience to write a short story on a post-it note, something we call a post-lit. Francisca Hayes wrote this one.
While watching the local news, I couldn't avoid hearing that an alligator had invaded another house. It looked like the resident was a gator fan. This guy was so proud to have this visitor, he couldn't hesitate. And with his arms, made a gator jump to the camera. This is so Florida.
Don't worry, you don't have to have a post-it note handy. You don't even have to be a gator fan in order to write a post-it note. We've created a virtual post-it note for you online. You can write your story. It's at WLRN.org/postlet. That'll do it for the Florida Roundup. Let us know what you're talking about on facebook.com/groups/theFloridaRoundup. The program is produced by Alicia Zuckerman and Gina Jordan. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our digital editor is Maria Muriel. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Chibeli Herrera. And our technical supervisor today, Paul Leary. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.